From calculated breath control to belting it out for the toe-tapping folks all the way in the back. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. I'm Jason Burns.
And I'm Danny Nucci, and this is the What About Vocal Performance Podcast.
With Eric McCormack, which was, you know, I was editing this episode together before we're recording this, and man, he really does have an amazing voice, even just a speaking voice. And I'm thinking, Eric's got to be doing more animated work, more voiceover work.
Eric is quite busy enough. Don't he doesn't need any more. I mean, the guy's unbelievable, and he is. I mean, he does interpret those songs and sings them really well. I mean, just, you know, like there was stuff off Yellow Brick Road that he did at his show that is terrific. And then, you know, he's also done musicals. I mean, he's like a real. Like a real singer.
You've heard him do some of these songs. He talks quite a bit about Freddie Mercury in our interview. Have you heard him do a Queen song?
Maybe, yeah. I think I might have heard him do a Queen.
Yeah.
I mean,
does
I don't
he
recall.
Hit those notes?
I don't recall.
He goes way up?
Well, you know, you don't have to do that, especially when you reinterpret it. It's your song. It's now your song when you're singing it, which is one of the things that he does well. But he is the karaoke king. I mean, like, he'll bury you.
He said he was going to remove that from his Instagram. I'm going to go and see
By the way, is that nuts that he literally, like, I literally just was, like, saying that. And it's, like, a thing. I didn't realize that. I just look forward to him doing more of it and more public and allowing more people to see this part of him because it's really terrific. What a joy it was to talk to him. I'm a huge fan. My pal, Eric McCormack. Hello, welcome back to Los Angeles.
Thank you, brother.
Did you have a nice trip? He was in Vancan.
I was in Vancouver. Yeah, crammed a lot in, which was kind of the purpose of it. I was, before I go traveling for months and months, I wanted to see my buddies up there. And so there was a lot of dinners and a lot of running around.
Now, you grew up in Canada, but you grew up on the East Coast, correct? Toronto?
Yes. Grew up Toronto. I didn't go to Vancouver, which was just sort of on a whim. I was like 28, 29, and my agent in Toronto just said, look, it's drying up here. There's a lot going on out there. And I don't know, it's Canada's different than this country in terms of travel. We're so spread out, and it's not feasible in this quite the same way to travel your own country the way people might.
You can't just road trip across Canada, right? There's too many.
You can, but it's twice as wide, you know. So people growing up in Newfoundland probably rarely get a chance to see Vancouver and vice versa.
Do you have your own Route 66? Like, is there like a way to go from Toronto to?
Oh sure. Oh yeah, but I'm not gonna do it.
No, not driving from Halifax to Victoria anytime soon.
they got planes for that.
So growing up in Canada, Eric, and being a lover of the arts, is that like the move? Like, do you go to Vancouver? Like, is that what, like, people here going from Boston to LA to make it?
If you were going to move from somewhere to make it in Canada for years and years, that would be Toronto. But then around the late, and Nucci, you'll be familiar with this. The late 80s into the 90s, suddenly Vancouver had so much television. It had all these Stephen J. Cannell shows. It had 21 Jump Street and Wise Guy. And then, of course, it had the movie Alive. That was the year I got out there.
92, yeah.
It was 92. I had been out there for 2 weeks. One of the first auditions I had was Alive. And it went so well. And they were like, it's down to you and some guy named Danny Nucci.
That's not true. I know that's not true.
That son of a bitch.
I know that's not true. But they were also doing, was X-Files then?
X-Files started. So there was a reason that my Toronto agent literally shooed me and just said, go, there's nothing happening. And of course, eventually there was lots happening in Toronto. But that particular couple of years, Vancouver was on fire.
And then CW started shooting everything up there. Supernatural, yeah, and those shows.
Yep, and that's very true. And Hallmark now shoots like, I don't know, 90% of their 200 Christmas movies every year up there.
Well, what they discovered is the crews are just as good at 60 cents of the dollar.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty sporty working crews.
Pretty good deal.
Crazy.
Well, in Vancouver, looks like everything, right? You can have a little bit of every setting.
Yeah, And I love particularly when we get to use, which is pretty rare, but get to use Vancouver for Vancouver, which we did on my Netflix show Travelers. We didn't ever say the words, but we didn't hide anything. It was
that it was Vancouver, yeah.
Which was awesome.
Before we get to Travelers, right? Because this is, I read some things about you that I didn't know. I mean, obviously, I knew that you were Stratford Shakespeare guy. I knew that. But were you? What I didn't know was anybody creative at home? Was mom, dad, anybody like super creative at home? Singing, dancing, singing lessons, dancing lessons. Was anybody like that?
Well, I mean, I've told this story before, but I do love to tell it because it's fascinating.
But not to me.
Not to you.
I want to know.
The short answer is no. There was sort of none of that. I was this strange unicorn that was in plays from, you know, first grade on, and insistent on being in the second grade play and the third. And I mean, it was, and my parents would dutifully come and were so pleased that I liked that I had a hobby. And my father was particularly once I got to high school and it was full on musicals and I was in competitions and that's all I could think about. Every time his response was very kind of, well, that was good for you. Yeah, well done. Good, you know, like typical kind of, he was a financial analyst for Shell Oil. Mm-hmm. And then he wanted me to go to.
So touchy-feely guy is what you're saying.
That's hard.
Real touchy-feely guy.
Very, very emotional and huggy.
Effusive.
but as it turns out, secretive, because he really wanted me to go to a university. I chose not. I chose a theater school, you know, for just a diploma in Toronto, called Ryerson at the time. And second year at Ryerson, I discovered a treasure trove in my parents' attic of photos and articles about my father's days as an actor in the radio and television arts program at Ryerson.
Wow. At the same school.
At the same school. We had a teacher in common.
Come on. And he never said anything?
Never said anything. So we're 30 years apart. He graduated in 52. Which just tells you how long that Jack McAllister was teaching speech.
Yeah.
But I went to my mother and I said, who the hell is this? And she just said, that was your father before he chickened out, is what she said. Uh-huh. So, which is not a terrible thing to do in 1952 in Canada. There's not,
no, it's a little,
you know,
little different climate for that sort of thing.
You know,
thing,
it's like Lauren Green and that's about it. So
what a cool thing to find. I found Playboys in my dad's attic.
Exactly. So, and then I confronted him and he was very, in denial, I suppose. He would just kind of say, well, I wasn't as serious as you. But I just, when he said it, he told this to me in a mall, a very busy mall in downtown Toronto during lunch. And he tried to leave. And I said, well, we got a little more time. You want to get ice cream or something before I go back to class? And he turned back around and he was crying. And he said, I'm very proud of you. And he hugged me.
Wow.
And he walked away into the crowd and we never spoke of it again.
Wow.
In the next 20 years. Yeah.
So do you think that he was like, that was his dream? And he just like, you know, your mom said that was before the dad you knew now, but he just kind of walked away from it.
Yep. I think that I talk a lot in I have a one man show that I do, and I talk a lot about dreams because mine, that's all I had. I had just, there was no B side to me. There was no fallback position, even though of course my parents were typical parents of the 60s going, well, but you could always teach or something. You know, no, there was zero other option for me.
But and when talk to other people, when you talk to other colleagues, when you talk to your other friends that were at Ryerson and then later were in Stratford with you, did they talk about fallback positions or what they were going to do as alternatives, or was that just the common sort of perception because you're young and you're like, it's all going to work out?
I would say at Ryerson, I mean, we had a class of 34 in our first year at Ryerson. I think by the third year, there were 15 of us. And mostly it was people just being cut from the program because they weren't all they were supposed to be. But I also think in some cases, it was just sort of a disillusionment of like, wow, huh. I guess, I don't know if this is me. I don't know if I'm, because it's about making a living. You know, it's not just a dream. It's not just.
We spoke to Dennis O'Hare, the actor Dennis O'Hare, who was in Chicago in a very prestigious, at Northwestern, really prestigious program. Nobody is an actor that he studied with except him, which I found absolutely fascinating. That's, which is why I ask, I'm wondering, like, because, you know, it's kind of a unique thing to go, fuck it. It either works out or it doesn't.
Yeah. I mean, of those 34, I know of two that are still, you know, very much at current going concerns in Canada. I spent the weekend with three of my classmates from that class. And one of them is an acting teacher now. And the other sort of became a writer. And the other's out completely. So it's, I mean, I think it's what the market will bear. And I think for my one friend, Gabrielle, she was, in my opinion, the best actress in the class, the one most suited, certainly, to a theater life.
Yeah.
But she pretty much right out of college went, yeah.
That's what Dennis said as well. The best actors in his class just went, no, I'll go do something else.
I'll just go do something else.
So, Eric, I have to ask, did you ever go back to that teacher or professor and say, hey, do you remember my dad being in your class?
I did. I mean, shortly thereafter. And I mean, whether he really did, I mean, 30 years ago, but he was a very eccentric man that walked down the hall like he was carrying.
And he was still there. He was still at Ryerson.
He's still teaching. He taught me speech.
Oh, wow.
And he was just an odd guy with his dog always in class. And
I like him already.
I know. I said, do you remember a Keith McCormick? And he said, of course I do. I'm not sure that he did, but it's the long answer to your question, Danny. It was there all the time, almost like a Manchurian candidate kind of thing, was waiting to awaken in somebody. And so I think from then on, my father would come to, you know, see a taping of Will and Grace and turn to Jim Burrows and go, you know, I taught him everything he knows.
No, he did not.
You don't recall like him ever like slipping into a character in Home, anything like that, that showed any signs of his theatrical past?
Really not. I mean, he was fun and playful, but had a great laugh on him. I mean, the biggest thing my father gave me in so many ways was he'd let me watch some more grown-up stuff in the early 70s, like All in the Family and MASH. And I'm nine or something, and Monty Python. And I would watch my father laugh hysterically at those things. And I think that more than anything taught me my sense of humor, because I didn't get everything. I mean, think of all those Bugs Bunny jokes. We didn't really understand the reference, but, you know, 40 years later, you're like, oh, that's what Daffy was talking about.
Yes. You know? Yes.
But I just knew something was funny. I knew Alan Alda was funny. I knew Archie Bunker was meant to be this thing that I didn't quite understand all the time.
And laughter's infectious, right, Eric? So if your dad had a great laugh and you're hearing him laugh, you want to follow in his laughter footsteps in a way.
Yeah, it's that, and it's also taste, right? Like, these are the things I just mentioned are the greatest things
Monty Python and that tickles your funny bone, I mean, you're gonna inherently understand the funny.
Yeah,
you were also the oldest of three, Eric. Did you feel like you had more responsibility? I'm the youngest of three, so I was kind of the forgotten one. Everybody had already dealt with everything else before me. But what did the eldest role give you or lead you to today in terms of personality and just the way you live your life?
It's an interesting question. I've, you know, we've all done therapy. Some of what I figured out in therapy was that probably as the firstborn, it's a really, I don't know this for sure, but it's a good possibility that my mom had postpartum and that she didn't know how to deal with it. So I think I found a tremendous independence very early on, mm-hmm. 2 years old. And that led me to, I wasn't dependent on them. I was not a latchkey kid. She was a stay-at-home mom, but I would come home and I would disappear into my room. And the games I played in my room, in my basement, I had one friend, God bless him, named Bill. And together, the stuff we did from sort of the ages of 8 to 12 were sort of the bedrock of
your imagination,
my imagination, and everything that I don't even think of it as. For Bill, he put away childish things eventually and became an engineer. But those things are why I'm an actor.
Childish things,
you know.
We're just, still... it's just funny to think of it. Like you're like, you know, we're you know, and on the back nine. And we're still children, you know. It's just very, very funny to me.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm always curious about actors that find it later, you know, that were like pre-med and then went, ah, I can meet girls if I go to, you know, because for me, it's always been there. And it's such an investment. I've just fully invested all of me in it. And so when I say put away childish things, I mean, there just came a time probably by end of eighth grade where he was like, well, I guess I should focus on my studies. Like, really? Because I'm going to pretend to be a rock star in my bedroom. My parents kicked me out. I mean, full on, you know, for the Freddie Mercury tights and the Alice Cooper wig. I mean, I was doing it all in there.
So when you finished, I mean, we talk a little bit about it. Just give me like a little thumbnail of the Stratford experience and doing all those Shakespeare plays. And did you start getting the funny roles? Did you start getting all the humor roles? Did you start to notice like, oh shit, I'm funny?
Well, that is sort of what happened. But I mean, so my biggest influences as a kid were funny. From you know, Mel Blanc on the Looney Tunes to Get Smart to the shows I mentioned with my dad. And then eventually at like 12 or 13, I discovered Woody Allen. And so those were my biggest influences. It's who I wanted to be. And yet once I got to theater school, it was all about Shakespeare. It's a very classical school. And the biggest achievement it could be leaving theater school for an apprenticeship there. And that's what I got. That's what happened. So I spent five seasons there and everything changed. I understudied Colm Feore and there was good people at Stratford at the time. And I learned a lot and I was very imitative. I just wanted to be those guys now.
Sure.
For a while. And then eventually I realized that maybe it's not first and foremost what I love. And the comedy started to creep in sometimes where it was not welcome.
You know, it's funny. Paula does the same thing. Like, I'll have like a dramatic piece and she'll be like, you know, this would be really funny here. Yeah. I'm like, it's not a comedy.
I know. And it was, so my last year, I finally got a couple of good roles. I got a Tusenbach in Three Sisters and Demetrius in A Midsummer Night's Dream. And in each case, I was searching for the funny. In my mind, Demetrius is the funniest role in Midsummer. He's not. But I was pratfalling. I was everything I could find. And also, as Tusenbach, I was very nebbishy. And at one point, John...
I was going to say, you're going right into Woody Allen right now. You're literally going right into Woody Allen.
We were doing a dress rehearsal.
Listener
can see it. We're doing a dress rehearsal, and my hands were in my pockets, and clearing my throat and John Neville was directing it and he stopped right in the middle. He said, right, Eric, he's a Russian baron. He is not Woody Allen. And at the end of, this is a totally true story. At the end of that season, John left as the guy running the place and a new very, very staid Englishman took over, David William. And I was called to his office at that time of the year where you get or don't get an offer for the next season. He said, I don't have an offer for you for next year. And I said, that's fine, David. Maybe it's time. He said, yes. I don't like the way you play lovers. It's very modern, isn't it? He said, I suppose it is. Yeah, you're right. And he says, have you ever considered, I don't know, television comedy?
Did he really say that? Oh, wow.
He said it in 89, and he did not mean it as a compliment. He meant that as, well, you can't actually do this. Right. Perhaps you could do something else. Right. And I it hit me like a dagger. And like I said, I knew he was putting me down. But 9 years later, he was right.
But what a great story, too. I'm sorry, Danny, but just like you started out watching sitcoms with your dad, and yeah, that's what you fell in love with. And then being able to, I mean, just think of how many kids fell in love with acting, watching you on a
right
sitcom. I mean, you know, the same thing.
And I hear that all the time. I mean, somebody stopped me the other day and said, I teach a comedy class or something. I said, "Oh, that's wonderful." And they said, "We're doing scenes from Will and Grace and studying your technique." And I said, "Fuck, it's just a pastiche of everything I've stolen."
Well, I was gonna say, what is like your technique? I mean, I don't know how you teach you. It's so intuitive, it's so instinctive, and anybody that's spent any time with you outside off of a set notice that it's just natural, man. I mean, I don't know how one could put that kind of intuitiveness and sharpness into a study program. I have no idea.
Well, and particularly when I can tell you in any given moment who I'm stealing from. So it's, you know, we're all just sort of a patchwork quilt of influences. On Family Guy, what's the character's name with the great big chin that is
Quagmire? Quagmire.
This really, I love, this is why my son sent me this. I had no idea. There was a scene where all the guys were up in the attic and Lois comes up and she says, "What are you guys doing up here?" And our lead says, "Oh, Quagmire was just doing his Eric McCormack impersonation."
Oh my God.
And Lois says, "There's no such thing."
Oh my God. Wow. That's great. That's not true. I can see certainly a Will impersonation for sure.
I thought that was hilarious that there was simply no way it's like he was trying to insult me and say I'm nondescript. But it makes me laugh to think, when I think of me, what I do, it's a little this and a little that and a little this and I stole from there. And so I don't know.
I've told you this story, Eric, but it was one of those great things. You know, I was friends with Phil Hoffman and I've told you this story, but I'll tell it for the listener. I'm sitting with Phil Hoffman. It was one of those, like, I'd just seen him do a play in New York and he came to LA and I said, "I'm picking your brain. We're having coffee." And he's like, "Okay." And so we sat for 2 hours and talked and talked and talked. And we were talking about acting and he goes,
"Yeah."
It's like, "Yeah, man, Will and Grace, I mean, they're doing incredible work."
I don't remember you telling me that story.
Yes. He goes, "They're doing incredible work. Me and my wife, we watch it. And I just watch and they're just doing incredible work."
Wow.
Yeah. That was literally the one reference that he made in terms of what he's watching or what he's doing. And it was Will and Grace.
Banana. I met him only one time. Shortly before his death, his wife had been the wardrobe designer on an off-Broadway show called Some Girls, a Neil LaBute play that I did just after Will and Grace ended. And so I just met him for 5 seconds. And he was very complimentary, but just part of you going, "Sure, you're Philip Seymour Hoffman. You're not watching the sitcoms," but that's great. That's
No, it was, he absolutely loved it and was thrilled by it. And amazing. Yeah, and it was funny because that was what he was, you know, referencing most in terms of, you know, the kind of work that's out there now that people are really doing extremely well.
Well, that just makes my day.
You know, you mentioned this was your dream. You had no other backup plan. Right. This was your focus. So when Will and Grace became this big hit, did you have any moments of a sort of be careful what you wish for? Because here you are experiencing a success in a way that probably nobody could prepare for. And I think a lot of people, especially like our kids' ages, probably don't understand what TV was like even just back then, where everybody was watching the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, I absolutely did have that moment. I could almost compare it to, you know, when people get married and they're like, "Oh my God, I'm making this commitment. This is it." And it's with television back then, you know, you'd go into your final audition for the network and you had to sign a contract even before you'd done the final audition that said that they had you for 8 years, and which of course every unemployed actor is like, "Great, great, great." But there's also that moment where you go, "This is my episode.
What if I don't like this?" Yeah. Yeah. Well, and also if you've been working and you're a professional and you've had other opportunities, yeah, and this isn't your first thing, the idea that, are the scripts still going to continue to be good?
Yeah.
Is my character still going to be interesting? Is this something I'm going to want to do? And it's all at their discretion. They want you for 7 years, you're theirs for 7
100%.
Years.
100%. And Jesse Tyler Ferguson was talking on somebody's show the other day about how he said, I think the reason that in success, actors make more money in seasons, you know, 6, 7, 8, it's not just that the show is a success. It's that the longer you're on TV, the longer the gap probably between when that show ends and the next time you're able to be cast in something that isn't that.
Mm.
It's almost being paid knowing you're going to be typecast.
And then you have the Ellen Pompeo and Mariska Hargitay situation. Where
right.
That's who they are for decades.
But you also have to be, you have to accept it, right? You have to be okay doing it.
Yeah.
And you have to love it.
Yeah.
You have to love it.
You know,
yeah.
And someone like Mariska, like I watch how she is such a leader on that show and clearly admired and loved. And at the same time, it's like, I couldn't solve crimes for that many years. I just couldn't do it. I did a 3 years on a crime solving show and I was like, it's tough. It's really, I think that's the toughest work.
Well, you're doing a lot of chuffa. I forget who said it, but it used to call it chuffa where you're just constantly giving information to the audience.
Captain exposition all the time. And, and always with those moments, cause you need six of them per episode of, you know, going to commercial. What's that final moment? What's the push in moment? I'm like, well, I guess he's not here anymore. Or, you know, some dumb line that's like, well, we have to do it to cut to the Kellogg's box, but oh, it's tough. It's tough. Whereas I think, you know, that's why we're in love with streaming as viewers. I think not only is there no commercials, but there's just none of those sort of moments that we associate with why television was a little bit, was the idiot box for so many years, because the writing had to fit a mold and there was simply no getting out of it.
But it's so overwhelming now though, because somebody tells you a show is a hit and you can't actually qualify it. You don't know if it's true. And then you talk to some people and you're like, have you seen
totally
that?
Agreed.
Like,
no, I mean,
I haven't seen that.
And yet the Sean Hayes and I were talking about the remembering those days when, because we had shot something 3 weeks earlier and it aired, and then the next morning we'd come into rehearse and you could talk about the ratings. How did we do last night? It's a very particular experience.
Yeah,
it's always
remember that. How did we do? Well, they're not. Well, the demo.
We did well in the demo, but we won't know the rest till 11:30. You know, it was cool, exactly. But it was also nerve wracking as hell. And, you know, now it's like, I did a show called The Other Black Girl for Hulu last year. And it's like, how are we doing? Oh, they're not releasing us for 8 months? Okay. In 8 months, let me know how we're doing. And then they do. And you're like, and? It's like, we really can't tell you for 90 days. And I'm like, all right. I don't know.
What about vocal performance?
We want to get into vocal performance because everybody knows you as actor.
But nobody knows you as the karaoke king.
I got to take that.
the karaoke king, Eric McCormick. Let's not kid ourselves here.
Let's start with the big first question, which is, as you think back over the years, what is your single greatest vocal performance moment? And why is it stuck?
Wow. You just start right
going right
that.
In.
We're not going in how it happened. Nope. Did you start with musicals?
You could start with
that?
The best, then you work your way
voice?
Back.
When did it turn into singing?
Yeah.
Well, songs that you loved? I mean, none of it. We're just going to the best.
I'll shape it now. Jason just threw the big one at me. I'll shape it now into an answer. God. Well, first, the one that sits with me is the one that was the first one, the one that changed my life. I always say I measure my life in BC and AD, before I was Jesus Christ and after I was Jesus Christ. It was my 11th grade production of Godspell. And I'm sure it was not in any way my best vocal performance, but the moment of presenting those first two songs to the school in an assembly kind of situation was the moment I went from being, you know, just a nobody geek to I could walk down the hall in my rainbow suspenders and I could
own it.
I'd get a girl. But
what a visual. Did you have the big hair? Did you have the big
age? I had big hair. It was not permed, but it was big. It was awesome. That began it. And so it was a very musical theater dream for years. But ultimately, I don't.
So you were singing from a young age, Eric?
Yeah, I did. But I would say I didn't know I could sing. By the time I got to 11th grade and I was auditioning for Godspell, I had fully discovered Queen and Aerosmith and everything else. So
you were putting yourself up against Freddie Mercury in terms of vocals.
I was, but also, oh yeah, but also like unapologetically Manilow.
Mm-hmm.
I loved ballads and stuff.
What about
like
some Steve Perry from back in the day?
That's getting a little out. That's like if I could sing like Steve Perry, that's what I'd be doing.
I was gonna say, right?
Really,
that's
if you've got that shit, you do it.
Yeah, you're in the wrong business being an actor.
Yeah, exactly. The one I really, I know, of course, Elton and Billy Joel, and but the voice I most resemble, I think, is an incredible Canadian singer named Burton Cummings, who was the lead singer for the Guess Who. Mm-hmm. And he had a tremendous solo career in Canada. And I really, really listen to his records a lot. Best vocal performance. This is a very specific one. I want to say 15 years ago, I was asked to sing a song. It was an original song for the completely, what's the word I'm looking for? When you bring people together again, the reunion for the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And it was a song that somebody here in town had written called Mary. And they asked me to sing it, and all of them were there. And it was just one of those nights where I think that was just on a vocal level, that's where I felt.
So you sang Mary for the cast of the Mary Tyler Moore Show? Wow, that's intimidating.
It was intimidating and amazing. And backstage afterwards, I got to meet all of them. None of them were dead yet. It was incredible. I guess Ted Knight was gone, but I got to meet them all. And Ed Asner came up to me drunk, and he grabbed me by the shoulders and he said, You made an old man cry.
Oh, man. I had interviewed him once, and he said, just before we got started, he goes, I just want you to know, I don't want to be here.
Hilarious.
Which really made me a nervous wreck the entire time. But then he was a sweet man after that.
Oh, yeah, he is sweet.
But I actually got to witness Eric do like an entire show of like doing cover songs.
Oh, yeah, right.
Friggin' incredible. When did you start going, you know what, I want to do more of this, just essentially rock pop, you know, singing with a band or with the accompaniment? When did that, because obviously I joke that you're the karaoke king, but you love karaoke and you're very good at it. When did you go, you know what, I want to try to do more of this. This, I really like this. I really enjoy it.
Well, two answers. One, the karaoke king thing is dumb. That's just one of those dopey things I put on my Instagram. But when people hear karaoke, they...
By the way, I didn't get it from your Instagram. Okay. I just know this from you. I just, I said that knowing you, I've never heard the term before. I thought I just named you, monikered you.
Monikered myself, and I got to take it down. But when people hear karaoke, they think I'm talking about a bar, which was the case 30 years ago. But we've had karaoke, ever-expanding, evolving system in the house forever. And we throw karaoke parties, sometimes just for two other couples or something. But it's I love that because I can't stand going to the bars where it's always the same people and they're going to only get their one shot and they're going to sing the same goddamn song they sang last week. I love a really warm room where people can really, and nowadays you can, there's an app called Carafun, but you can also find it on YouTube. There's almost any song you can find a version, a karaoke version. And so I love doing B-sides. I love doing songs that maybe nobody remembers. And pretending that they're mine. And I think what happened with the show you saw an earlier version.
Yeah, that's what it was. It was deep cut. It was basically deep cuts, you know, Elton John deep cuts. Yeah.
My friend Joe Candido going, it was something people know. And I'm like, that's not what this is. But
there's some hits in there. There was hits in there.
One or two. Sure. But the show that evolved, you didn't see this show specifically, Danny, because this was more of a just my buddy and I playing songs, but the show that developed about 10 years ago, I was just dying to talk about the fact that more so than the shows I pretend like Get Smart or whatever, it's the musicians I pretended to be in my bedroom, because I took it so seriously.
You became them? You like inhabited?
I had the wardrobe. Everything in my room was an instrument, even though I didn't play any actual instruments. But I've had the same tennis racket for 45 years. You know what I mean? Very soon. So I
still play the same. Okay. Neck is still good.
No, I mean, a lot of the strings are broken, but
still plays. Sure.
But I just thought, like, so people like Elton John and Burton Cummings, and I grew up to have stories about them. They were I could tell a fun story about and Manilow and about meeting them and having a friendship with them as grownups. So that was kind of the show. The show was called The Concert I Never Gave, Except for Like 2,000 Times in My Bedroom. And it's just, it's me singing some of the songs I've always wanted to sing with a full band. I mean, like a five-piece band. And then stories in between, the silly stories about being 15 and then being 35. And
is that the Toronto show that you sort of do annually kind of thing? Yeah,
part,
right?
It evolved out of that.
Yeah, yeah.
I did it once, twice in LA, once in Toronto, and twice in Vancouver. And it hasn't been, I haven't done it since, but it's, they are my favorite stories mixed with the experience I always wanted, which is just singing with a band. Which, you know, you get to do all the time now, Danny, which is, I'm very happy for you.
But which came out of a karaoke experience, which I think I've told you, right? I was trying, the karaoke machine broke.
Okay.
So the band leader who was in a band, and I was not in the band at the time, said, go get a guitar so that we can continue the karaoke. And I took my little phone out app and I started playing karaoke songs for the people that were there. And we were all singing together and I was the karaoke machine.
Amazing.
And the band leader looked at me and went, oh, you're in the band. Oh, sorry, what? Oh, you're in the band. I'm what? He goes, yeah, you sing, you'll play guitar, it'll be great. That's how that ends.
That's so great.
There are all these stories of charity table reads. I think you need a charity karaoke event is what
100%. I mean, the one of the, I don't think this was for charity, but one of the first things that happened after Will and Grace had a name, VH1 celebrated the 25th anniversary of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And they asked me if I wanted to be part of it. I think Rashida Jones did it and Ashton Kutcher and it was the Hard Rock Hotel in Vegas. I said, I'll do it. But they called it a karaoke event. I said, I'm not going to karaoke. I'm going to do it. if you can provide the full hair and makeup, I'll do it. So I did Sweet Transvestite and I'm Going Home.
Such a good one.
They had like experts there that do up the people that, you know, that perform in front of the screen and that kind of thing. And it was, that might have been the greatest musical performance of my life in terms of just
literally,
you know, it's somewhere out there on YouTube.
You just were able to embody the whole thing and do it. That's fantastic. It's fantastic. And especially, you know, doing Frank is just the best.
Well, I always tell the story about my dad that he was, I'm 13, I'm 14, and there's suddenly girls on the wall. There's Cheryl Teagues and Linda Carter, and then there comes the rock bands, and there's Rush and Queen, and they're getting more and more scary to a father in his late 50s. But he never said anything. He never said anything until I put Frankenfurter on the wall.
And that was it.
And he walked past my bedroom, and I always say it was like a Clint Eastwood moment. He kind of passed it, and then he backed up again, and he pointed, and he said, get that off my wall. Like, oh, Dad, you are in for it in the coming years.
You're in a great room right now. The acoustics here are great. Where's the best place to sing in your house? You mentioned having some events. What's the room?
It's probably the living room here, and we have a place in Vancouver. It's the same sort of thing, although the setup there is not great, but the sound is good. I love, there's two versions of it I love. Like my friend Vince up in Vancouver will always say, let's just you and me karaoke. So we'll just have an afternoon. We'll just, you know, because then it's my turn, it's your turn, it's my turn. And we can really experiment with some strange shit. But the other is a bigger party where there's a few people that are just not convinced, that are just like, this really, are we doing this? I don't. And by the end of the night, they're doing their fifth song and
life,
shoving you out of the way.
I want to ask you a listener question, because we have a listener question for you.
Oh.
The listener asks, Wells F. asks, as far as capitalized your ear is concerned, who are the best vocalists of all time?
My ear, he says?
Yes, your ear.
My ear. Wow. Interesting. I think here's the thing. Like with television early on, I always wanted to be, we talk about these singers, I can't say, there was a time I could do a pretty good Freddie, I could do this, I could do that. It's not the case anymore. It's mostly the singers I wish I could sound like. And that ranges for me from, you know, from Steve Perry or Freddie Mercury was probably my favorite. Freddie and Burton Cummings and Elton John. You know, two, like the freaking like Brian Johnson from AC/DC. Like I just, anything I can't do vocally. And every time I meet a musician, particularly a singer, I'm dying to know, like, how do you still do it? How many shows have you missed? Do you drop the key? You know, and there, a lot of them, the answer is the same. Elton and Daryl Hall, they said the same thing to me, which is, I do this every day. This is my life. I don't think about it. Whereas I know with someone like Freddie, because he partied a lot in the later years, that he did have to, there were notes he couldn't hit on tour.
Your co-star Sean Hayes just spoke to John Bon Jovi, who just went through a vocal surgery and might not be able to do it again.
I mean, Bon Jovi's a perfect example of that. He wasn't Steve Perry high, but if you look at him, you go, in some ways he was. In some ways he was effortlessly. And of course, he's still outrageously good looking. It's nuts. But the fact that that is what you've done for your whole life and what you've been able to do into your 50s and 60s, and now it might just go away.
Scary, yeah. Did you see the We Are the World documentary?
Yeah, just did. Yeah.
I just watched that last night, and watching Bob Dylan be so nervous being around those other singers, it was like this weird, sweet moment. But at the same time, you're going, yeah, Bob, I get it.
Yeah. I always loved Billy Joel, too. There was a time when these guys were touring so much, and he's such a great, prolific pop songwriter, then just pumping it out. And some of those early Billy Joel vocals were pretty great too. I love Linda Ronstadt. Love. And there's another great voice that was silenced by illness. How about for you guys? What's yours, Danny?
I don't know, man. I just go right to contemporary. It's hard for me to get past Adele these days.
No.
I just what she can do. I mean, all you need is a friggin' piano. You know, and she just fucking soars.
Yeah.
I'm also a huge fan of John Mayer's singing voice. Mm-hmm. I just think it's so unique and interesting, and the way that he phrases. I think nobody phrases better than Frank Sinatra. To me, he is the king of phrases. So, yeah. I mean, it just goes, the list goes on and on.
Sam Cooke, throwing some Sam Cooke in there.
Sure. I mean, those guys, I didn't have an appreciation of a lot of, particularly the black music in the 60s to later. And then it was like, good God.
Yeah. I mean, you listen to any of those doo-wop singers and they just have so much, such a tone to them. Smokey Robinson, his tone.
Smokey Robinson and what Diana Ross was doing and Aretha Franklin, all that stuff. I was too young at the time to appreciate. And my wife, my parents were like, you know, Sonny and Cher and Nana Muscuri was about the biggest they were going to get.
Sonny and Cher. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee.
Did that just happen? That's great. I love Cher. That. I mean,
that
was one of the shows I watched all the time as a kid. And I think it was the first concert. My mother took me and my sister to see Sonny and Cher from the worst seat to the grandstand in Toronto.
And she eventually did Will and Grace, right?
She did, yes. I mean, we couldn't look her in the eye, but there was...
That's not true.
Not true. That was Madonna.
I don't know what it is about him, but just the way he frames things, just I don't know, he just strikes my funny bone. I mean, I know he's funny, but he's got like a lilt in the way that he says things that just, I don't know, man, just makes my face hurt.
Well, when he was portraying Ed Asner after saying that he had to perform for the whole cast of Mary Tyler Moore Show, is it insane? It's just insane.
By the way, I don't know that he has nerves. I mean, he is willing to do anything. Like, he's just, I mean, he stressed it. Like, I remember when he had one show where he was singing, and he was a bit stressed about his voice and making sure that it was rested. And you know, like he's professional in that way. You know, kind of what we were talking about, Dennis O'Hare.
Right.
Where, you know, opera singers, like that's all they're worried about is their voice all the time. And you know, when Eric's got a show, you know, you're not going to talk to him. There's no phone time. You're not chatting on the phone when he's got to
sing. It's crazy that he is this great vocalist and his co-star in Will and Grace
Sean Hayes is also this great vocalist. He does all this crazy stuff on Broadway with his voice. And here they are in the same show together. And now they actually have a podcast together as well. It's crazy.
Well, I think that's part of what we find out when we're talking to these people. You know, there's numerous passions and arts that people get into that sometimes are just lesser known, but just as impactful and wonderful.
Well, and he talks about being in his bedroom dressed as Freddie Mercury and I think it was Bill Cummins. Is that the guy he was talking about from Love and Spoonful?
Mm-hmm. Not Love and Spoonful.
The Guess Who. The Love and Spoonful. Where did I get that from?
I like that. That's John Sebastian.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome back. Dreams were your ticket out. Right.
Well, it's amazing that he's been able to live this out because so many kids don't get to see their dreams become a reality. And man, I love that he can do that.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, this was a treat. Thank you all for listening.
Music by Denny Nucci. Produced and edited by the same two people you heard hosting this show, because they have no friends.